The aim of this book is to help a new administration think critically about the future of American national security policy. Indeed, it's to help all Americans think deeply about how national security policy should be formulated after the Bush Doctrine.
Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. In June of 2007, our program here, the GAGE program, which is Governing America in a Global Era, led by Jeff LeGros and Mel Leffler, put on a very interesting conference in which they invited leading thinkers and practitioners in the field of foreign policy to come here and contemplate what the foreign policy changes would be after the Bush Doctrine. Let me tell you a little bit about Jeff LeGros and Mel Leffler. Jeffrey LeGros is the Compton Professor of World Politics and is now serving as chair in the Department of Politics at the University of Virginia. And Jeff LeGros is one of the principal faculty members in the Miller Center's Governing America in a Global Era, or GAGE, program. Jeff LeGros got his undergraduate education at Middlebury and his PhD at UCLA. He was a Fulbright Scholar in China Foreign Affairs University in Beijing, and among his books is Rethinking the World, Great Power Strategies, and International Order. Mel Leffler is the Edward R. Stettinius Professor in the Department of History at the University of Virginia, and like LeGros, is one of the principal faculty members in our GAGE program. He was educated at Cornell and at Ohio State. He served a term as Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and is the author of four books, including A Predominance of Power, National Security, the Truman Administration, and the Cold War, for which he was awarded the Bancroft Prize. Mel Leffler served in the office of the Secretary of Defense during the Carter administration, where he worked on arms control and contingency planning. Mel Leffler is currently working on a three-volume history of the Cold War. Together, they have edited a very important volume of essays drawn from the Miller Center's 2007 conference. The volume is called To Lead the World, American Strategy After the Bush Doctrine. Please welcome Jeff LeGros and Mel Leffler.
Well, George, thank you for that very kind introduction. And I want to begin by thanking Governor Beliles and the Miller Center. They supported this project from its inception. And our two colleagues in GAGE, our two primary colleagues, Sid Milkus and Brian Bella, were really indispensable collaborators to us in putting together this volume here. But most of all, perhaps Jeff and I should thank Ann Mulligan because she really orchestrated the conference that was indispensable to the making of this book, and then she truly expedited the copy editing the final formulation of the manuscript in an extraordinarily timely way. So Jeff and I really do want to thank Anne for her efforts. The aim of this book is pretty simple. It's to help a new administration think critically and analytically about the future of American national security policy. Indeed, it's to help all Americans think deeply about how national security policy should be formulated after the Bush Doctrine. To do this, Jeff and I asked some of the most eminent scholars in the country to come here and to discuss with us what national security policy should be in the next administration. So the essays in this book are written by some of the nation's most eminent scholars on national security, Frank Fukuyama from the NITSI School of International Affairs of Johns Hopkins in Washington, D.C., Niall Ferguson, Samantha Power, and Charlie Mayer from Harvard University, David Kennedy from Stanford, Steve Van Evra from MIT, Bob Kagan from the Carnegie Endowment of International Peace, John Eikenberry from Princeton University, Jim Kurth from Swarthmore, Barry Eichengreen from Berkeley, and Doug Irwin from Dartmouth. Now, I mention these names because I know many of you have heard of these people, many of you have read their books and their essays. You know that they come from different disciplines. Some are historians, some are economists, some are IR, international relations experts, some are political scientists. Some have had experience in government, some have not. They come with very different political dispositions, and perhaps most of all, they have very different analytic assumptions. We asked all of them to do a similar task, to write a basic national security policy paper for a new president. Every new administration since the origins of the Cold War has written a basic national security policy paper. And indeed, such a paper is now mandated by Congress in an act, in a legislative act that was written in 1986, the Goldwater-Nichols Act. So every administration has to do this. But we prodded our contributors to transcend the usual generalizations and to try to get beyond the platitudes that often characterize these formal papers. We asked them to identify threats and to specify goals. More importantly, far more importantly, we asked our contributors to assign priorities to these threats and these goals. We asked them to address as well the importance of values in the making of national security policy, and we wanted them to make judgments about the relative importance of values vis-a-vis interests. Now, frequently, values and interests coincide with one another, but the challenge is to determine what you do if they clash with one another. Further, we asked our contributors to examine domestic and international institutions and processes. Do we have the mechanisms to make effective policy? As many of you probably know, the basic mechanisms, the basic processes in place in the United States government were formulated in 1947 and 1949 at the beginning of the Cold War. Do these suffice in the contemporary context, in the post-Cold War context? And lastly, we asked our contributors to consider whether the policies they advocated could win sufficient support at home and abroad. No matter how good a foreign policy or a national security policy seems in an abstract way, it's not going to last if it doesn't garner support both at home and abroad. Now, formulating national security policy is tough, really tough. Let's begin, as many experts do, with defining threats. The United States faces today multiple dangers. There's the threat of terrorism from non-state actors. Peter Bergen was here on Friday and gave a terrific talk at the Miller Center on Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. There's the threat from terrorists. There's the threat emanating from the prospect that weapons of mass destruction will proliferate. There's the threat stemming from the behavior of so-called rogue states like North Korea and Iran, and the threat that emanates from failing states, clearly Somalia, Sudan, and perhaps most ominous of all, perhaps Pakistan. Then there are traditional types of threats, the threat emanating from a resurgent Russia or an ambitious China. Then the threat that stems from America's tremendous dependence on overseas oil, the prospect of energy shortfalls. then a looming long-term threat that may exceed the significance of all these other threats stemming from climate warming. Then there's the possibility of pandemics like AIDS. And then, if you woke up this morning and listened to the radio, you know the problems stemming from domestic financial and economic problems, especially trade and budgetary deficits and the weakness of America's great financial institutions. Now, almost always, we at the Miller Center and experts at other think tanks ponder these issues in isolation from one another, as we should. Each of these, terrorism, Russia, China, each is a complex problem in its own right. But the beginning of any real national security planning starts with a sorting of these items, with risk assessment. Reasonable people, of course, will disagree about what constitutes a major or the major threats. That's fine. But judgments must be made about the primacy of threats. Without these sorts of judgments, it's hard to create a hierarchy of interests or goals, which we asked our contributors to do. What are the most important things for the United States to accomplish? We asked our national security experts. That's what the people in a new administration are going to be faced with immediately. What are the essential goals? You have to address this question in order to begin to make the indispensable budgetary decisions. For example, if we define our interests in terms of containing authoritarian regimes like Russia and China, if we define our interests and our goals that way, we may focus on building up traditional military capabilities. But if, on the other hand, we decide that principal threats and primary interests reside in overcoming energy shortfalls, or in modulating the warming of the planet, or in thwarting the spread of disease, then we need to assign resources, budgetary resources, in very different ways. Likewise, if we believe that terrorism and halting proliferation are key dangers and constitute primary interests, we need to configure our military forces and conduct our diplomacy in vastly, vastly different ways than if we judge China and Russia to be primary threats. Indeed, if we think that thwarting terrorism and halting proliferation are the greatest dangers, then we want to go out of our way to secure help from China and Russia and treat them as prospective allies. Finally, if we judge trade and budgetary deficits to pose the greatest risks, we then need to reassess the degree to which we can focus on these other goals, the goals that I just enumerated, or whether the United States can or even should preserve its leadership role in the global arena. Indeed, if we think that budgetary and financial issues pose the greatest dangers, we may need to focus on domestic issues as the primary ones rather than these traditional national security issues. So we asked our contributors to think through these complex issues. Some of them wrote essays on what they've decided were the overriding problems, for example, reviving American legitimacy and prestige, or reducing inequality in the global economy. Or they wrote essays on restoring America's respect for national sovereignty abroad and willingness to accept shared sacrifice at home, in effect, jettisoning the essentials of the Bush Doctrine, the doctrine that calls for preemption and anticipatory self-defense. Now, most of our authors claimed that America's interests and America's values coincided, that it made sense, for example, to focus on democracy promotion. But some of them pointed out that democracy promotion could have extraordinarily adverse effects. For example, look at what's happened in Lebanon with Hezbollah, or in the Gaza Strip with Hamas. They therefore, these contributors, these skeptics about democracy promotion, thought that democracy promotion might be recast as the promotion of civil society and the respect for the rule of law. Now, the moderators who were here for the sessions at the Miller Center a year ago, June, were struck by the very discordant voices that they heard, the conflicting perceptions, the disparate goals. And it seemed clear to the moderators who were here that forging a consensus amongst the so-called experts seemed hopeless. But forging a consensus was not the primary goal of Jeff and myself. Our goal, in fact, was to illuminate the complexities and the trade-offs so that intelligence decisions could be made by a new administration. Our goal, moreover, was to do something more. It was to show how key assumptions can shape one's entire perspective. In this respect, there are two or three essays that demonstrate how assumptions shape conclusions. In effect, we are invited to assess whether the assumptions are correct and whether the conclusions follow from the assumptions. Steve Van Ever from MIT, for example, begins with a brilliant and succinct analysis of how US national security imperatives have changed in the aftermath of the Cold War. The overriding danger facing the United States for most of the 20th century, he says, was that a totalitarian power or a coalition of totalitarian powers could dominate the resources of Europe and Asia and use them to challenge the United States for world supremacy. Van Ever tries to show that this threat that dominated national security policy thinking for almost the entirety of the 20th century is now over. And without this specter, our interests and our goals are vastly transformed. In his view, neither China nor Russia have the remotest possibility of dominating all of Europe and Asia. Hence the conclusion that our priorities must focus on terrorism, proliferation of nuclear weapons, and climate and disease control. Now, Bob Kagan totally disagrees with this. He contends that the fundamental issue in global affairs remains the divide between authoritarian and democratic regimes. History never ended, he said, and the obvious threat for the United States remains Russia and China. And therefore, we need to form a concert of democratic powers or a league of democracy to counter these types of traditional threats. And therefore, we also must hone our traditional military capabilities to deal with these threats. John Eikenberry from Princeton, in his essay in this book, a terrific essay, that happens to disagree with both Kagan and Van Ever. And he says that we cannot tell what are the greatest threats. We'll never be able to tell the greatest threats. Therefore, it's impossible to enumerate a hierarchy of goals or interests. Therefore, what follows is that what's of real importance, of primary importance, according to Eikenberry, is to forge multilateral institutions, in other words, to construct tools and processes to restore legitimacy and credibility to the United States that will enable our government to deal with a multitude of evolving risks as they arise. Now, many of the participants, including Eikenberry, Van Ever, and Kagan, left daunted by the very disparate views that they heard. And David Brooks wrote an article in the New York Times that after having sat through the conference for 2 days, it was impossible to say what our foreign policy should be. All he could do was outline the differences. Now, Jeff and I were also daunted. We had to figure it out in order to write a conclusion to this book. And Jeff will tell you what we decided upon.
Did we agree on that division of labor? I just want to just start off by thanking Mel Loeffler. I don't know how many of you know him, but he is he's a great scholar and a great person. And I don't know if our next president will have wisdom and judgment, but I know from working with Mel for several years now that he has it. And it's been great doing it, Mel. This book is interesting, right? It provides we, the public, and our leaders with this variety of very colorful, interesting, really neat maps for the future, you know? And they're not just flat maps. They've got mountains and all kinds of bells and whistles. When you read these chapters, you really see some great minds at work. And the problem Mel has pointed out is that they're all different, these maps are, and we don't have confidence, we're not certain they're all gonna lead us to the goal we wanna get to. And so really what we struggled with a bit was, what is going on here? Are we left with nothing? And what we realized is no, actually these chapters, as diverse as they are, as diverse as their authors are, from lefties to righties and everything in between, and in this time of partisan rancor and the notion that we can never agree on anything, actually have several shared points of consensus. These are what we might call foundations of strategy, and they're a type of checklist, a checklist you might use to assess what presidential candidates are saying, and they're a checklist you might use to assess what the next president is doing. Are they pulling together a policy that will work? And there are five foundations of strategy I'm going to touch on today. The first is leadership. Now, many of you might have thought, what chutzpah to lead the world. There they go again, those crazy international relations specialists assuming America is the top dog and can go out and do what it wants to. But you look at these authors, again, from left to right, they all agree that it is that the U.S.'s role in the world is what Madeleine Albright called the indispensable country, that the world community cannot resolve its problems without leadership, and that the United States is in the best position to provide that leadership. Now, the odd thing I'm going to talk about just briefly today is that these foundations of strategy, these points of consensus, they're not just among the authors. We went out and we said, okay, so maybe the authors, maybe we picked a certain segment of authors who share these principles, and it's just limited to them. So we wanted to know, might these points of consensus hold up and get political support in the United States? And might they hold up and get support in the world? And actually, all of them, to varying degrees, do actually elicit some amount of support. So for example, the public is not really key for the United States to be the world policeman. We don't want that. But we do recognize that the United States does need to play an important role in solving the world's problems, right? What Americans are really afraid of is they don't want to get stuck with the bill, right? They want America to have a say, and they recognize that it's important the United States take a leadership role. What they want is hegemony Dutch treat, right? We want to spread the bill a little bit. But there is support for leadership. And surprisingly, U.S. international opinion, despite all the talk of anti-Americanism, also does support U.S. leadership, right? That there's a large majorities in many countries that say the U.S. needs to be involved and it needs to do its share. And even if you spend a fair amount of time in China, as I did a few years back, the Chinese do not say, we don't want the U.S. in the Pacific. They just don't want the U.S. deciding everything, but they recognize the United States' role in the Pacific is critical and desirable. Second principle, preponderance. All of these authors agree that the U.S. must maintain its military preponderance in the world. That is, its role as a dominant, or at least very strong, military power. Yes, they disagree on how much of a degree that U.S. should have. They debate its uses, as I'll get to in a minute. But military preponderance they see as essential for the United States helping to resolve and deal with the problems that occur in the world. They need it. The United States needs it not only for security, but also for influence. The public agrees. 55% of us believe that military superiority is important. A lot of us think we're spending too much on defense, but we also are for a stronger defense. Those two things are hard to reconcile, but there you have it. Now, international opinion is somewhat less convinced of the importance of U.S. preponderance, but it often depends on where you are, what part of the world you are, and who your neighbor is, right? So if you're Poland, you think U.S. preponderance is quite important, and if you're the Philippines, you think U.S. preponderance is quite important. Third principle, freedom promotion. Let's distinguish that from democracy promotion. All of our authors agree that it's quite important that the U.S. be a voice in favor of the spread of liberal values. Again, we'll talk in a minute. They disagree on how to do that, dramatically disagree on how much to do that. But they believe that it is important that the U.S. be a voice for the spread of freedom and liberal values. When we poll people in the U.S., a majority of us are actually against democracy promotion. But I think that's because democracy promotion is associated with Iraq and forceful, the use of military force in promoting democracy. I think that what you see below that kind of rough answer is actually a fair amount of support for the notion that, yes, it is good and in some places when appropriate to push liberal values. What's interesting is that in the international political arena, there is also support for this notion. It's odd, isn't it? Because right now we're hearing a lot of talk about the rise of authoritarianism and the authoritarian model of politics. But what you don't have is an alternative normative model to democracy, to the notion of political freedom that's challenging that U.S. model today. This was different, of course, in the Cold War. So even in China, Chinese don't say democracy is bad, we want to remain in the political system we have forever. They say it's going to take us time and we're going to have our own style of democracy. But the normative value is not challenged. Okay. Fourth principle, economic openness. All of these authors, and I was very surprised by this, embrace the desirability of an open, capitalist, global economy. Now, they differ on the amount of safeguards one would want at home, especially in dealing with inequality, by those who are hurt by an open economic order. But all believe it is important and desirable. 53% of Americans say trade is good. Now, that sounds like strong support, doesn't it? But in 2002, that number was 78%. So what you're seeing is a fairly quick drop-off in support among the public for U.S. openness. This would be one of these indicators that where you see, yes, people support it, but it's changing rapidly, down from 59% last year. So in 1 year, 59% to 53%, something to watch. Ironically, the United States was the lowest of the 47 countries assessed on opinion in terms of support for an open trading order. That is, there is broad global support for open trade, despite concerns over inequality, the environment, and cultural implications of openness. Fifth principle of consensus, international collaboration. All of the authors agree, from right to left, that we should seek multilateral institutionalized cooperation, that we should build rules and organizations, that we should forego unilateralism most of the time, and respect international law. Domestic opinion supports this as well. 91% favor working with allies, 90% would say we should respect others' views, 69% say we should work through institutions. And in terms of international public opinion, yes, there's distrust of the United States and other countries. But in many countries, majorities want the U.S. To cooperate more in managing problems. So what you see there is five principles shared in the political spectrum, across the political spectrum, that have some amount of domestic support and some amount of international support that suggests that these principles could be a foundation for building a policy that would not only sustain a lot of momentum, but also perhaps have a chance for success. Okay, so that's the good news that's lying through these chapters. And that's also things that at least I'm thinking about when I say, hold it, how is that person's strategy wrapping together these five principles to put together an effective policy? Of course, it would be wrong to stop there, because if you read these chapters, you'll be struck by disagreement as well. And as Mel said, we're not trying to formulate a single national security plan, but to illuminate the trade-offs. And so let me just quickly touch on five areas where the authors disagree and what the trade-offs involved are. I think the first is the nature of the future international environment. What is the world going to look like, and what are the greatest threats? This is what you can't get around when you look at these chapters. And they're fundamental issues, and I don't really think our presidential candidates have really addressed these trade-offs yet, or these overall views. But they have to do with, as he mentioned, whether the world is going to look like it did in the past or look anew, whether states are eroding, state sovereignty is eroding, and with what consequences, and how we arrange threats. And the issue, of course, is that we can't simultaneously accept all of these visions of the future. You can't simultaneously address all of the pressing threats in the world, the ones identified particularly by these authors as terrorism, the return and unity of authoritarian states, rising economic and military powers, chaos in the periphery, failed states, inequality in the international global economy, U.S. debt, and the collapse of the world economy. You can't meet all those problems at the same time. You have to make choices and trade-offs. And the question is, are our leaders making those choices and trade-offs in the right way? Second issue of disagreement, U.S. standing in the world. This is a topic of particular interest for me. We'll be having a panel on this in March of next year on this issue of U.S. standing in the world. But the question is it important? Does it matter? Some people out there say, it doesn't matter. Of course there is anti-Americanism. The U.S. is the dominant power in the world. People are not going to like it just because of that fact, no matter what it does. It's ephemeral. It goes away. We don't need to deal with it. Others, however, believe that it is quite important, that U.S. standing in the world is kind of the goodwill that makes deals get cut. It allows you to get a lot more bang for the dollars you're giving out there, and allows you to wield more influence. Which is right? You're going to hear, and you already have heard, the two presidential candidates say their primary foreign policy goal is to restore U.S. standing. But if you listen closely, you'll see that they're talking about very different things, right? John McCain is generally talking about U.S. credibility and in terms of wielding power and standing up for its word. Barack Obama is generally talking about the U.S. as a moral force in world politics and as a model to other countries, right? So there's trade-offs on what you do with standing and how important it is. Third, hard power. Okay, so we agree that military preponderance is important. What do we do with it? And how much influence can it have? So what the authors disagree on is, do you continue to build a conventional military force that deals with major power conflict, like the United States was doing up to the war in Iraq? Or do you orient your military around counterinsurgency strategies for dealing with these non-state actors and difficult and troublesome criminals and terrorists around the world? It's hard to do both of those things at once, and there are big choices to be made. Second, how important is hard power, military power, and influence? a lot of the authors believe that there has been too much emphasis on hard power in the past and not enough on soft power. But others don't. They disagree. Fourth issue, the spread of democracy and freedom. As I've said, people believe it's important to spread liberal values. Our authors believe that. But how important, and how do you deal with it? And is this not brought to a nub in just one example? Again, China. Right? How hard do you want to press liberal values? Do you want to press liberal values on the bet that China is going to be trouble in the future, that it's only in the country's interest to press democracy and do it now with all the consequences that would have for trade ties and the possible liberalization of China, or not? Fifth point of dissension, international cooperation and institutions. Yes, desirable, but which kind? Some people want to just build international institutions among democracies, not among the whole world. Others want to construct a global concert, an alliance of sorts between the United States, Russia, and China. Can it be done? Is the United States willing to sacrifice any of its sovereignty in building such new institutions? Dilemmas that aren't answered. Each of you probably has a response. But it are trade-offs involved. And these are the types of issues, these five issues, that we'll be watching very carefully as we assess the candidates and as we assess the next president's foreign policy. So our purpose, in closing, is to highlight the dilemmas, not a single plan. And all I can say is to really appreciate these, you have to read these chapters. They are a wonderful encyclopedia, easy guide to the best and most interesting ideas out there on the future of U.S. foreign policy. The next president is going to have to act. The surprise of our work, of course, is that there are not just dilemmas there, but shared foundations that can be relied on, used to build strategy that might work. I want to leave you with one more fundamental dilemma that the next president is going to face. A lot of our authors did not speak so much to the domestic politics of strategy. But the dilemma any president faces is how to formulate a foreign policy that has support, that has consensus, without overselling it in a way that blinds us to the subtleties of the world, right? So in a certain way, after the Cold War, we were sold on the threat of communism. And communism, and Truman sold communism because he had to generate consensus among a tired country, tired from war, and arouse them to the challenge out there. But it came communism, not Soviet communism, Chinese communism, or nationalistic communism, all of which had different types of subtleties to them and called for different policies. And calling them communism sometimes blinded us to their, whether they were monolithic or not, pushing them together as we might not otherwise. So the last dilemma for a president is how to build that consensus, and how to build that consensus in an era when there hasn't just been a major crisis that might allow people to come together, but how to do it at a time when the challenges are somewhat uncertain and somewhat vague, but nonetheless critical. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. I'm going to move to the back of the room. And for those who have questions, and I hope there will be many, please queue up with me at the back of the room, and we will address as many as we have time for. As I am moving to the back, I'd like to direct a question to Professor Leffler, who has previously written about the battle for the soul of mankind, and ask if he still thinks that it's important for America to have a soul, to have moral standing in order to effectively lead the world. And if so, does he agree with some who feel that as a result of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and so on, our right to any sort of moral leadership has been impaired? And how would he advise our next president to try to recover America's soul or America's claim to moral leadership?
Well, that should take the rest of the afternoon. George is referring to a book I wrote about the nature of the Cold War, and it raises important issues for the relative importance of values. And I think the clear and brief answer to a very complex question is yes, the United States, in my opinion, must pursue its values. It's an integral part of what we now call America's soft power. But in pursuing American values, in the very act of pursuit, we must not destroy those values. And that's been the conundrum in Iraq and in many of the policies that have been followed the last few years, that in the pursuit of American values, we've really discredited those. So one needs to do this in a subtle and nuanced way. And several of the essays in this book engage that issue in a very sophisticated manner. And one of the really important, I think, generalizations that emerge from the essays is that the promotion of democracy, which is the way this administration has almost always characterized its goals, democracy promotion. As Jeff indicated in his remarks, the United States should be pursuing more broadly notions of freedom. And that means, according to several of our contributors, to promote long-term the rule of law and to promote all sorts of institutions in other societies that really will give rise to a more effective civil society.
My name is Jim Parrish, and I want to say thanks for your comments. My question has to do with basically the domestic problems. And we are very fortunate here at the Miller Center to have some very outstanding speakers. One of our recent speakers was the Dean of the University of Virginia Medical School. His comments were that $1 out of three in Medicare is fraud. In case anyone didn't hear that, I'm going to say it again. $1 out of three in Medicare is fraud. Now, I realize the people who are committing the fraud are voters, and therefore Congress obviously does not want to get at these people because you cannot vote if you're in jail. But the second thing, we've just recently seen that out in California, a number of hospitals are going to Skid Row and getting people, taking them in, keep them in the hospital for a while, and then putting them back on Skid Row and basically charging Medicare. Now, how do we solve those kind of problems?
That is an excellent question. Our next volume, To Recover Our Health, is going to be out in a couple of years. Now, it's an excellent question. I mean, it speaks to, I don't have an answer to that. Mel probably does. But it speaks to the notion, I think, of where should our priorities lie? Should they lie at home or should they lie abroad? And the answer to that is one that we all know by now, that those two can no longer be separated, that the abroad and at home are linked. And if we are tied up overseas and in situations that we otherwise could have avoided, we could spend more money and attention on our problems at home. We know that our problems at home and our problems with our home mortgages are now cascading abroad and coming back to us in other ways, that we can't solve those problems without thinking about the linkages between the international and the domestic.
I would just like to add to that, all human endeavors of importance are fraught with risk and with problems. And I think that it's easy to trivialize the role of the government, for example, in dealing with issues like Medicare. There is a lot of fraud. The temptation, of course, is to think, let's hand it over to the private sector. Well, open your newspapers today or listen to the radio and ponder the degree to which you really have faith in your private financial institutions to conduct policy with probity. So the answer is really not to condemn the government in a superficial way, nor to condemn the private sector, but to really grapple with how you bring together the best that can emanate from both the private and the public sector. One of the characteristics of the Bush administration, for example, has been to privatize large aspects of American national security policy. And most people who have been observing this think that in the very act of privatization, huge problems have emerged in terms of efficiency and efficacy. So what the question illuminates is a very difficult problem, but it's not one that has a simple answer. Oh, the government can't do these sorts of things.
Hello, and thank you. My name is Brenda Beasley, and my question is to begin with all of the participants and contributors of this book. Did they all begin with a consensus that the Bush Doctrine has truly been proven disastrous?
I don't think they shared that conclusion, no. I think many saw problems with the doctrine, and of course, you know, we're all Monday morning quarterbacks to a certain degree. We can pick and choose those things that obviously did not work well. But I would say there is at least several people in the group still sympathetic to the doctrine. And as you read in your Washington Post this morning, there are people out there who are trying to defend it, praise it, resurrect it, think that history is going to be kinder to it. And a lot of this revolves around, not a lot, but at least a good portion of it revolves around what happens in Iraq. As things go better with Iraq, you see more efforts to try and revive some of these ideas.
Bob Kretzinger, excellent summary of important essays. I would suggest that it's incumbent on people setting forth a strategy or a plan to also set out evaluatory metrics or criteria 10 years, 30 years hence. Can we look back and have certain guidelines or metrics to see how successful a policy has been?
Well, I think that would be possible if you could, you know, get people to agree on exactly what those metrics should be. Now, if you take the issues of commonality, like the United States should lead the world or preponderance of military power, things of that sort, you might say those are metrics. But I don't think that they get to the fundamental issues. And the fundamental issues relate to the solutions to the types of risks that we face. I mean, you know, if we have fewer carbon emissions, you know, 50 years from now, will we be, you know, is that a correct way to be addressing climate control? Or if we have certain types of multilateral institutions in place. So if we could get people to agree on what constitute the most important dangers and what should be the most important goals, then we can begin to set metrics. But until that happens, it becomes, you know, very difficult. Any new administration that comes in, they're going to fight over this. They're not going to fight over the metrics, but they're going to fight over priorities. What are the, you know, what are the greatest dangers? What are the greatest goals? And people are going to disagree, but they have to make decisions. And if you don't make decisions, then things are going to get messier and messier.
About the principle of military preponderance, it's all very well as long as the military is in a kind of a preventive mode. The problem comes when they are called to action some kind. And that is mostly because in the last few decades, the public's willingness to support action diminished very, very fast as soon as they see the body bags coming back, which is, of course, mostly due to the quick high-technology communication, and also sometimes flamed by the heat of political campaigns. How do we keep that support up?
It's a good question, and you know, as I mentioned in my remarks, I'm struck by some of the recent data where a large majority believes we're spending too much on the military, and a large majority favors a stronger defense. I think where some of the divide lays is that preponderance does not necessarily mean simply overwhelming military force and ability to use it, although some of the influence that comes from military force is inherent in the notion that there is a willingness to use it. And some of the concerns of this administration were that U.S. Power had diminished, not because its power had diminished, but because people didn't believe it could be effective or competent. And once you showed it was effective and competent, others would rally to your side. And I think that if to fully kind of represent the debate today over military preponderance, it's also as much about the notion that you need military preponderance to provide for freedom of the seas. You need military preponderance as a source of influence in your foreign policy by helping to support states and security forces in other countries to make them competent so they can deal with, for example, some of these non-state threats. So the debate's example in the book about the preponderance of military power are about the fact that you should have it, and debates about how you use it. And using it is not simply about putting it into force, into the military, into battle. And indeed, some people would argue that almost most of the time, you're just not, that isn't the purpose of military force. It's to save and secure for when the big issues come up, and you're better off using it as a supplement and leverage in a non-force-oriented way.
I had a particular interest in your comment about international organizations and trying to work through international organizations. You talked about the League of Democracies from one hand, and the other working with China and Russia and the United States and some other term you had. I'm wondering how the United Nations fits into this. United Nations is working, for example, on Millennium Development Goals, which has tremendous importance to world security. They work on the global warming, which also has vast implications on world security. And I'm wondering how the United Nations might be integrated into these either League of Democracies or the other type of organization you talked about. And did they talk about that that integration or not?
Yes. Well, I mean, your question gets to one of the profound disputes among some of the writers, and that is whether or not to work on refashioning and reforming the United Nations and preserving it as the fulcrum of all multilateral institutions, or whether to really, in essence, junk it. And some of the more conservative contributors, you know, do not think that anything effective can be done through the United Nations, and that anything that's important to do will be stymied there. And hence, it's important to create a concert of democracies. Bob Kagan is, you know, a great advocate of creating it, and he's written the speeches for John McCain, in which John McCain talks about concert of democracies. The real problem with that right now is that most of the democracies don't want a concert of democracies independent of the United Nations. So you don't find, you know, our partners in the European Union or Japan calling for a concert of democracies because they think that it's going to split the world in two in ways that they don't want to do. So other, you know, people who care about this sort of thing, John Eikenberry, also in his own way supports a concert of democracies, but not in place of the United Nations. The real challenge, as I see it, and I think Jeff would agree with this, is the need to establish numerous multilateral institutions that intersect with one another and ultimately buttress the United Nations rather than supplant the United Nations. And when Strobe Talbott was here a few months ago talking about his new book, he supported this idea. So it's not to supplant the United Nations. Most people, and I think most of the contributors, want to strengthen the United Nations, but also understand that you have to forge other types of regional multilateral institutions and agencies to deal with certain regional and local problems that that can be integrated and reconciled with the most important endeavors initiated by the United Nations.
It seems that none of the contributors cite declining U.S. competition or financial security as a cause for concern. And in your conclusions, you write that this is either collective wisdom or possibly a blinding bias. And I was just curious as to your own personal conclusions on this issue.
On financial issues?
Financial security.
Financial security. I think it's probably, there's a couple authors who pay a lot of attention to it, Barry Eichengreen and Doug Irwin and Niall Ferguson. And there's a reason for this, and that's because the first two are economists, and the third, Niall Ferguson, is an economic historian. So they care about economics and understand it in a way that perhaps some of the other thinkers don't spend a lot of their time thinking about, right? So there's a little bit of a professional divide in the field of international relations analysts. They tend to do security, or they tend to do international economic stuff, each with vast complexities, and it's hard for any one person to cover the gamut of the range of those problems. But I think all of them would say, yes, the health of the international financial system is important, but they just don't focus on that. It's a background condition. The ones who do focus on it are actually showed quite a bit of concern about the international financial system. And these are people who have studied it for a long and deep period, and of course, with the headlines in recent days, their concerns have really come home to roost.
Let me respond to that. In terms of what we've learned, I'd say, over the 50 years or 40 years of the Cold War is that the economic vitality of the United States, its capacity for innovation and renewal over time, the capacity of the very wealth of the American economy to generate innovative social programs, those are the types of things that over the long term became the envy of the world and constituted the soft power of the United States. So in a remarkable way, yes, foreign policy and domestic policy are interlinked. And I think what we have learned is that the vitality of domestic institutions are critical in the long term for the making of a successful national security policy. Not in terms, and I'm not saying this in terms of building up military capabilities. It goes far beyond that. It's the economic vitality of the United States and its capacity to deal with what are widely seen as critical social problems, like healthcare, as was raised. It's the capacity to do that and to innovate and to entertain the world, frankly, and to entertain the world, that's been the strength of the United States. And therefore, power resides in much more than military capabilities.
Yeah, and just one last coda on that really critical question. I mean, right, today we're back to debates about decline. Right, for those who paid attention to politics and international relations in the 1980s, we had these similar debates, right? And the answer to those debates was the 90s. Look at the U.S. system, it pulled it out again. It's a source of entrepreneurship and innovation that's going to continually be able to remake its economic power, which Mel has just perfectly said, is the ultimate source of U.S. Authority in the world. And the question, of course, is, will the system continue to do that? You know, will the U.S. come off the ropes again with another bout of entrepreneurship, or are there other issues in the economy, in the system, that will prevent it this time around from coming back so strongly?
My name is Curtis Crawford. On the issue of military preponderance, I have been very concerned since the time in the 90s when the United States decided to press for the expansion of NATO into Eastern Europe right up to the Russian borders. I wonder whether the issue of whether it is wise or good for the United States to have that policy in the present circumstances of the world. Came up in your conference.
Right. Well, this is a specific policy question today. It certainly has existed during the Cold War and after the Cold War, how much NATO should be expanded. And of course, during the 1990s, as you're correctly saying, NATO was expanded. Today, the key issue is whether the desires of countries like Georgia and Ukraine, which have, you know, spun off from the old Soviet Union, whether their desire to be in NATO should be recognized. My own personal opinion, this is a very specific type of question, but my own personal opinion is that it would be a grave mistake to include to include Georgia and the Ukraine in NATO, and that it would be an act of provocation that at this point makes very little sense. I think there are other ways to handle the real security and border issues and ethnic complexities that exist, but to make prior commitments to guarantee the countries of Georgia and Ukraine is a grave responsibility. And you might simply take note of the possibility that if Georgia had been in NATO 3 weeks ago, we might be at war today with Russia. We might have had the clear and unmistakable responsibility, if Georgia was in NATO, to come to its military defense. And we also need to grapple with the prospect that such types of commitments can actually induce countries like Georgia and Ukraine to take more provocative actions than we would want them to take in order to fulfill their concept of their national interest at risks that might involve us and all of NATO that many would regard as unwarranted. So my view is the one of many of the countries of old Europe, you know, like France and places like that, that are very skeptical of the utility and the wisdom of taking on these sorts of commitments.
Jeff LeGros and Mel Leffler and the other members of the GAGE program are doing important original thinking on the issues facing America, and for this we thank them.